One of the failures, I think, that of housing policy generally, and I would say this is probably not limited to housing policy, is that we don't think about where we're going to be in 3 to 5 years or even in 10 years, and we neglect when the time is right to put policies in place that prepare us for the future. So think about high-cost markets and how we don't get serious about thinking about high-cost markets until the market's completely built out, the housing affordability problems have gone through the roof, and we all wish that 10 years earlier we had been putting policies in place that would try to capture some of those units, for example, for affordable housing, that would have gotten some site control over some land in some of the really important areas. So what we've done is assembled some of the nation's leading thinkers on these issues about forward-looking trends to help us just sort of chart out where is this country going and what are the issues that we need to be anticipating so that during this lull in the housing market, we don't waste our time and waste this opportunity to put policies in place to really get us where we need to go. So I'm going to do the very briefest of introductions. You have on page 7 in your program much more detailed introductions. I'm going to introduce them in the order in which they will be sort of speaking initially. Nick Ritsinas, who is the director of Harvard University's Joint Center for Housing Studies. We will hear from Shelley Patisha, president and CEO of Reconnecting America, who also oversees the activities of the Center for Transit-Oriented Development. And then we'll hear from Dr. George McCarthy, Mac, who directs the Urban Opportunity Unit at the Ford Foundation. And finally, from Bill Klein, Director of Research and Advisory Services at the American Planning Association. And we're going to start out with some Q&A. And again, just as we can't possibly follow Secretary Donovan, for those of you who are at the Preservation Initiative, I'm not nearly as good as Erica and Deborah were in kind of moderating this. So you'll just, hopefully it is what it is. We'll do our best to have a conversation. And hopefully the interest and the weight of their ideas will carry the day. So I want to start out by asking Nick, the initial question really is, what are the trends that folks need to be thinking about as they plan their housing policy? And if you could just help us understand some of the demographic changes that we ought to be thinking about, some of the housing market changes that can help prepare us for that.
Thank you, Jeff, and good morning. I'm just so pleased to see all of you here. I would have thought you'd all be in your foxholes back in your communities trying to survive. So congratulations for coming out of those foxholes. I've had a chance a couple times to follow Secretary Donovan, and all I can say is we're really lucky. We are really, really lucky to have him there, and it's amazing. What I want to do for just a couple of minutes to answer Jeff's question is give you some sense of what are the demographic drivers that will shape markets and shape communities going forward. As I'm sure most of you know, last week we issued our annual report, The State of the Nation's Housing, which of course is available on our website. The headline is, the housing market is bad, it's really, really bad. But outside, beyond the headline, we talked a little bit about the changing sort of population, because while the data will be familiar, I think the implications are different given the environment we are in now. As I talk about these, I am reminded, I came across a reference the other day to Winston Churchill. Winston Churchill, of course, a famous leader in Britain during World War II. What many people don't realize is right after World War II, he was defeated for re-election. And in coming home after his defeat, his very supportive spouse said, "Not to worry, Winston. This is probably just an opportunity in disguise." And I will always remember his comment, which is, "So far, it has been effectively disguised." And so, too, as we look at the challenges of the housing market, I think they've been effectively disguised so far. But let me talk about four quick points. Point number one is we're still growing. There are still a lot of people coming to this country. We are still forming more households. Over the next 45 years, we'll add 130 million people in the United States. Put that in context, that's 46 Chicagos or 3.5 Californias. And they'll need a place to live. So we have a growing population. They have to live someplace. and we'll have to figure out where they're going to live, how they're going to live, what they're going to live in. Even in the short term, while the rate of household formation is down, it is still pretty significant. We estimate, even under the most conservative assumptions, we'll be adding about 1.25 million households a year for the next 10 years, which was about the rate in the end of the 90s and the beginning of this decade. So that's a relatively big number, and that's the number that'll finally work off this excess inventory that we have. Now, within that growth, of course, there are dramatic changes in the composition, particularly in the ethnicity of the American sort of population. The Latino population will, over this period of time, increase from 14% to 29%. The white population was back in 1960 was 85%. At the end of this period, in about 40 years, it'll be less than 50%. So they're pretty dramatic changes. The baby boomers, and sadly I have to put myself in that category, as I suspect one or two may of you may, will begin to turn 65 in a couple years, and in about 20 years, we'll all, if we're lucky, be 65 and then some. And that's going to have a very significant impact on the politics in the electorate. We estimate in about 30 years, one-third of all voters will be over 65. Imagine trying to sell them on school expenditures or school construction expenditures. It's going to be a very, very difficult sell. The echo boomers, the children of the baby boomers, the good news is there are more of them than there are baby boomers. So that's a good thing. The not-so-good thing, for the first time in American history, they will make less than their parents, and they'll be less wealthier than their parents. Now, I think the impact of that is that that would tell us that this is a market that is absolutely geared, appropriate for rental housing. So keep that in mind, point number one. This is sort of a renter-prone kind of market of kind of where it is. Point number two, the structure of the households will change pretty significantly. Back in 1950, over 50 years ago, half of all households were families with children, and less than 10% were single persons. Today, less than a third of all households have children, and one in four are single persons. And that's moving, we expect in the next 20 years, that less than one in four will have children, and over 30% will be single-person households. Now, that has significant implications for the size of the housing that we are building. That would tell me that we should be geared to sort of smaller housing. That tells me that condominiums, townhouses might have a competitive advantage given that sort of changing sort of composition. Now, again, we do have a couple of different markets in the United States. That's the market primarily of the aging baby boomer population. If you look at the recent immigrants, that market is a market of families with children still. So it's not a simple application, a simple template. Point number three, in this housing crisis, we have seen a return of a phenomenon that existed 30 years ago in this country. 30 years ago, we introduced the phrase starter homes. It was this notion of a first home for a new family. We stopped building starter homes. We stopped building starter homes. All of a sudden, we thought new homes were for people who already had a home and wanted a bigger and, quote, better home. Indeed, one of the proxies that we use in 1970, over two-thirds of all new homes built in the United States had less than 1,200 square feet, our proxy indicator of a starter home. At the height of the boom in 2005, it was less than 6% of all homes had less than 1,200 feet. Now, I work a lot with the nation's largest home builders, and some of them are starting to get it. Some of them are thinking about a very dramatic change in their business strategy, focusing on starter homes. The fourth and last point that I think is perhaps more subtle, but one that I think speaks to us, in my humble opinion, about the challenges. One of the byproducts of this economic crisis slash housing crisis are people are moving less. They can't sell their house. They can't get a job. There's no place to go to get a job. So they stay put. The rate of people moving from one city to another, from one county to another, from one state to another, has dropped dramatically. Now, notwithstanding the love affair that I have, and many of you have with cities, the fact remains when people move, there are more people leaving a city than moving in a city. Lots of data to support that. I think with fewer people moving, it provides an opportunity. And Jeff, let me finish with just a little personal anecdote on that that makes that point. I live where I was born in Providence, Rhode Island. Nice urban, small urban place in the Northeast. I live across from a neighborhood school that has been struggling since I have lived in that neighborhood because people have the means to go to private schools. When people's children reach school age, they leave and move, quote, to the suburbs and the like. Well, the school has been renovated and is reopening in the fall. It is over capacity with neighborhood children. Now, I like to think that's because they really like the city and they really like the neighborhood. But I think part of it is they can't afford to do anything else. They have to stay there. And I think that if we look at our neighborhoods and worry less about attracting people in the neighborhood and worry more about creating opportunities for people who already live in those neighborhoods, I think that's a way we might think of going forward. And that tells me that one of the issues we should spend more time looking at is the very boring issue of remodeling and home improvement. Because I think if we do find a way to do that, we'll find a way to keep neighborhoods vibrant. So those are the big picture issues, I think, that will frame or ought to frame sort of housing markets.
Thank you. Thank you, Nick. It's interesting to think about how that home remodeling point ties into some of the energy efficiency points that the secretary talked about and the administration is talking about. Is there a way to put the nation's out-of-work contractors to work remodeling older homes, stimulate the economy, lead to energy improvements? I'm interested in really understanding better where these people are going to live. So more renters, more single people, fewer kids in households, older population. Where are they going to live? How are they going to get to work? How are they going to get about town? Shelley, help us understand kind of where things are going in terms of trends in neighborhood development.
Well, thank you. And I'd like to kind of build on this whole discussion about demographics because I think it's really key to trying to see where we're all going, that there is a tremendous shift in housing markets and the kinds of housing that people are seeking out. But increasingly, consumers are looking at location, the array of amenities, and the ability to get around in their community with options other than driving as an important part of their location decisions. And in our work at the Center for Transit-Oriented Development, when we did our own look at the demographic trends several years ago, we estimated, simply based on demographic changes, that about a quarter of the future housing market was likely to want to live in what we call transit-oriented neighborhoods. After all of the gas price fluctuation that happened last year, we're seeing the level of interest in neighborhoods connected to the region by transit options just growing by leaps and bounds. Last year, we did a study that looked at what kinds of transit projects communities are looking at planning for. And we found, to our surprise, $250 billion worth of transit investments being planned in small communities, mid-sized communities, large communities, from bus rapid transit to streetcars to light rail systems to subways to commuter rail to high-speed rail. Just to put that $250 billion worth of community-based initiatives in perspective, the last transportation authorization invested $6.5 billion in transit investments over 6 years. So we've got an enormous demand coming from communities and a very small investment that we've had in the past coming from the federal government. And so this has really led to a couple of different issues, which I think are of concern to this community. One is we need to be able to put housing discussions in the context of community. That people increasingly are, for the various reasons you discussed, really beginning to place a greater emphasis on what is going on in their neighborhood, how will their community help them achieve their lifestyle that they're looking for, and to what extent can we think of affordable communities rather than just affordable housing? This is where I see the transportation discussion really beginning to come into play, and the Secretary and others throughout this conference have remarked on the information that we've gathered that now shows that location really does matter to the pocketbooks of low and moderate income households. And so really thinking carefully about how we can allow people or give people the opportunity to get to work without having to drive, which is probably the most expensive way of getting around, should be an enormous high priority for the housing community. But there's also kind of a danger in all of this, which is that if we don't get prepared, as Jeff said, during this housing lull, to understand that when the market comes back, there is going to be a tremendous push toward investment in those transit-oriented locations by those who have the means to be able to pay the high rents or the high housing costs. If we do not get ahead of that and proactively identify ways that we can have income diversity in those neighborhoods, the people who actually can benefit the most from lowering their transportation expenditures may not have the opportunity to do that. And so that, I think, is one of the big challenges of the next 5 years, is not only recognizing that the consumer preferences are really in a state of change, that location and accessibility and affordability beyond simply the affordability of a house is increasingly on the minds of consumers, but that we need to be able to get ahead of that and ensure that as we get ready for that next wave and retool ourselves to be able to build those smaller housing types that the market is likely to demand, that we are also thinking about the full range of people in our communities that really need to take advantage of those investments in transportation options. So I really see that as being one of the big waves of the future, and I hope that we can, as a housing community, reach out and hold hands with folks who are kind of in that transportation silo, so to speak, and try to find some shared solutions.
Great. Thank you, Shelley. Mac, we've been talking about trends at the household level and the changes that those trends are likely to instill in individual living decisions. Help us understand what the impact of this is going to be for metropolitan areas, and what do you see, what are the trends that are going to shape the size and shape of metropolitan areas in the next 5 years?
Yeah, thanks, Jeff. I think one of the things, and certainly one of the things that's really come out in this conference, is that two of the big trends that we're going to be seeing over the next 10 years are going to be changes in the way we actually manage and size and shape our communities, especially the metro area, but also profound changes in the way we do that. And so to start with the first one, the reshaping and resizing of metropolitan areas is going to take place and is taking place and actually has been taking place for the last 40 years as a result of industrial restructuring. And we've seen now there's just gigantic problems that have that we have to attend to that we've kind of quietly ignored as industrial restructuring has taken place since the 1970s. We have major industrial cities in the Midwest and throughout the country, even places like Springfield, Mass, that are just not configured correctly, and we have to figure out strategies to reconfigure those well. So one of the big challenges we're going to have is how do we resize these cities, and how do we do it in both creative and strategic ways so we don't let the resizing be done for us by blight and abandonment and disinvestment, but it's done in a way in which we can actually turn these older industrial cities back into amenities-rich destinations that folks will actually want to live in. We've seen some progress in some of the cities like Pittsburgh and others that have really tried to transform themselves, but I think we're going to really think about this now, or we're going to have to think about this now at a national level and think about it at a metro level, and we're going to have to really develop the right sets of tools and skills to be able to do that, and I think that over the next 4 or 5 years, we're going to see a lot of progress in that realm. On the other hand, the other thing that's helping to force the reshaping of metropolitan areas are going to be global and national mandates. And these are particularly mandates around climate change that are going to really require us to think differently about the metropolitan form. Because ultimately, if we're going to meet some of the really kind of ambitious goals we have in reducing carbon footprints, we're going to have to do something more than just increasing the fuel economy of vehicles or changing industrial emissions. And one of the things that they found out in California when they passed Senate Bill 375 was, in the analysis they did to reach their state targets for carbon reduction, they weren't going to be able to get there until they started to imagine ways that they were going to reshape the metropolitan landscape. Particularly, they needed to find ways to significantly decrease vehicle miles driven and ultimately to find ways to locate housing near transit and to find more efficient ways to kind of build transit at the metropolitan level. So those are going to, the ability to reshape communities as a result of kind of mandates on climate change are going to also require a set of tools that are a little bit different than the tools we've used in the past. And then finally, the way we do our work, I think, is going to be transformed indelibly, and I'm really encouraged by the way the signals we've gotten here at this conference about the transformation in the way work will be done at the federal level, but also at the local and metropolitan levels. And I think what we're going to see is the mandate to really bust those silos so that we can actually figure out ways to fund at the national level transportation, fund housing, fund energy in ways that are coordinated and orchestrated and are manageable locally. And one of the things that was really encouraging at this meeting, that we had so many officials from HUD here. I didn't go to a single session that didn't have at least three HUD people. And I think that the local people were really encouraged to think that HUD is actually listening, something that we haven't really experienced for at least 10 years. So I think that's a really important feature. We know now that the federal level is at least making the right signals and the right noises about working well together. And now the challenge is going to be, how do we develop the local systems, the local planning, particularly at the metropolitan level, that's going to coincide? Because what we don't have is we don't have people that are doing really, really effective metropolitan level planning, and we haven't been able to really make big inroads in breaking down the local barriers that prevent effective affordable housing development or effective metropolitan planning, the sharing of multiple burdens by multiple jurisdictions. And I think one of the things we're going to see is the erosion of home rule and the breaking down of really kind of the tyranny of local jurisdictions to really control planning and a lot of the decision making that has bad influences on the outcomes for the metropolitan area. So I'll just stop there. I think that these are, of course, 30,000 foot level stuff, which is what funders get to do. Right?
Yeah, that's what you're here for. Well, I want to, before we get to the tyranny of home rule, which is a very interesting idea here, but kind of just back up 1 second and pose the question that you asked to Bill, who works at the American Planning Association, and this question about how can planners help us break down some of those silos and think about integrating all of these different pieces in place. We all want it to happen. How can it happen, and is it important that it happen? What would you suggest?
Yeah, thanks, Jeff. I can't think about this stuff without hearkening back to my planning director days and thinking about the importance of thinking comprehensively and breaking down those silos. And it struck me that it would be useful for all of us to imagine right now that you are the mayor or the chief executive officer, county executive. Just think of that for a minute. Put that in your head. And think about all the single issue interests that are all competing to get on the top of your agenda. just tick them off, you know, streets and highways, emergency services, garbage, schools, crime, social services, parks, jobs, natural hazards, urban design, historic preservation, greening, energy, climate change, bike and ped facilities, and yes, housing choice and affordability is in there. So you've got a lot of things competing with each other on a single basis. And so that got me I don't know if I can do iambic pentameter, but it got thinking of a screenplay, okay? Here's the scene. We're in the mayor's office, and he says something like, "So now I understand the planning director wants to see me. I hope she's not going to hit me with that same old mantra, everything is related to everything else. Think comprehensively, think strategically. The comprehensive plan is alive and well. This is what she's going to tell me. Neighborhood plans are where it's at. And that I'm supposed to think long term, not about getting reelected next year. And that I need to think regionally." Regionally? Oh, man. And then listen to this. She says her proposed new upfront visioning process will tap into the inner karma of all our citizens and will emerge in one euphoric stupor of consensus. Doesn't she realize what it's like to be a mayor, to be hit with one single issue interest group after another, day after day? Fade to black, I guess. My wife, who's a writer, has always wanted me to co-write with her a screenplay about my experience as a planner. It may happen sometime. Well, enough of that. I think you get the point. If you want to break into the mayor's agenda on the top five list and get the attention you deserve, you need to break out of those single-issue silos of the past, and not create new silos, by the way. So I think there's a new paradigm of community building emerging in the U.S. And even in Washington, they're beginning to get it. In fact, the secretaries you heard from transportation, housing, environment, and energy have joined under the banner of more livable, sustainable American communities, as Neil Pierce put it several days ago. Now, that is exciting. And what's even more exciting is that housing people are getting it, too. Housing people are much quicker these days to recognize and deal with the problems and opportunities that resonate with or span across the principal goals, the issues of the single-issue silos of the past, and we're even beginning to seriously talk about region, particularly on housing needs assessment, obviously. So advocates of all stripes are asking themselves, can community health, active living, healthy eating, get the support it needs all by itself? Can hazard mitigation make it all by itself? Can complete streets be successful on its own? Can housing choice and affordability make it all by itself? So here's my theory. I think they can't, and I think you realize that. When housing choice and affordability, though, resonates with community health, resonates with jobs housing balance, resonates with energy and climate change, resonates with compact settlement, mixed use, bike ped transit, and sustainability, the theory is it should be easier to secure the critical mass of political and financial support necessary to get things done. So whether this theory of mine becomes a reality will depend on each of us. You can't do things the old way anymore. So what does this mean? It means reaching out and building alliances as never before with those unlikely individuals, organizations, and causes whose issues, when you scratch the surface, resonate with yours. Interests with which you might not have had a relationship in the past. It also means learning the language and the political dimensions of other sectors. It means having lunch with somebody on the planning department staff or even the planning director. It means dealing with the city, the town, the borough, the county, even if you're a nonprofit. So it's clear from what we have seen from the new administration in Washington that those who cannot break out of their single-issue silos and think more analytically, more strategically, and comprehensively will be left behind. So here's the bottom line. According to today's new paradigm of community building, your housing projects and programs must do much more than simply meet targets for affordable units. They're going to have to be energy efficient, have easy access to parks and healthy food, be well connected to transit and bike ped facilities, be located outside a hazard zone, be appropriately dense, and be part of a mixed-use neighborhood with plenty of fascinating walkable destinations. So that's a tall order, Jeff.
And in the afternoon, after you're done with that, you can go to a play or something. That's great. I mean, this is a very wide range of visions, although I think very compatible ones, interestingly. This issue of silos is interesting because, you know, we have silos within the housing world. And Secretary Donovan alluded to it earlier. Just one of the challenges is just getting all of the housing people to speak with a single voice. And now you want us to get to know these people in the transportation world and the education world and the health world. But I think you're right, ultimately, that there's only so far you can get with your small coalition focused on a narrow set of issues. And the broader we can make this, ultimately, the higher we're going to be up on the mayor's agenda because we come as a unifying force. I want to get into some of the specifics about how you actually do some of these things before opening it up to the audience. And I want to go back to Nick here. You mentioned some of the change in demographic patterns that we should be expecting and the change in household formation. What are the housing policies we should be putting in place to help us deal with those and anticipate those? And perhaps if you have a way to relate those to some of these other aspirations, that would also be really useful.
Well, I think Bill got it right. I think there are going to be new requirements, new ways in which housing has to connect to these larger issues. I was taken, if I could, Jeff, with Mac's comment about the tyranny of local rule. Years ago, I had the privilege and opportunity to direct FHA, and I recall going to industry meetings at the time, and people would say, oh, FHA is a dinosaur. This is the early 1990s. And my response, I listened to that for a while, then my response to that over time was, yes, it is, but dinosaurs lasted a million years. And so I kind of wonder, I suspect local rule is going to last a million years. I suspect silos are going to last in some ways a million years. I think what might be different, part of it is the demographics, the new realities, and Sheila talked up some of that. But I do think that we are at a moment in time where government is going to be given a little more rope to intervene in the marketplace. We don't have to convince people about government intervening in the market anymore, right? At least for the moment, the government intervention side seems to be the prevailing side. And I think, to answer your question, Jeff, to the extent I think the government, and I think particularly the federal government, starts to channel some of these things, starts to require some of those connections, then it will give a tailwind to what's happening at the local level. So I think that's where it's going to come. I'm not quite as optimistic about the dream of sort of regional government or the like. Matter of fact, I see, my own point of view, I see just the opposite. We're getting even more local. Now neighborhoods want to control development, never mind City Hall. You know, they only want their five neighbors to control who really lives in their community. The notion they're going to give that up to a larger area, I don't see it. I think we got a ways to go in dinosaur life to see that through.
Well, I think we should give Mac a chance to defend his assault on home rule here. Why don't you take the mic there and just tell us a little bit more about What do you mean about home rule perhaps being under assault? And also, how can we implement, what are the tools that we will have in place to help shape metropolitan growth?
Well, I think that, I mean, the issue with home rule is that land use planning, and particularly infrastructure development, kind of lays the groundwork and tells you the future of the city. And if you leave land use planning and certainly infrastructure planning to local jurisdictions, what you're going to end up with is that the shape, the structure of that infrastructure will reflect the local power that exists. So, for example, I lived in Massachusetts. I grew up in Massachusetts, and we saw the interstate highway system really devastate neighborhoods all over the world, all over the country. I mean, no place like New Orleans have you seen it worse. But when I lived in Massachusetts, I was there when the town of Milton was able to stop Interstate 95 from going across Boston. That was home rule exercise, maybe in the right way. What they did prove was they were powerful enough to stop the interstate highway system, but that didn't happen in Treme in New Orleans. It didn't happen in other places where they just couldn't defend themselves. And one of the problems we have with home rule is there's a huge amount of variability about what responsibilities local jurisdictions have to take for things that are important at the metropolitan level, like where you lay tracks for light rail, or who actually shares the affordable housing burden for the metropolitan area. And one of the things that we're going to have to confront is the land use planning that kind of tyrannizes the indefensible spaces who end up getting all the stuff that no one else wants and kind of continues to elevate the fortunes of the well-off at the local level. And somehow we're going to have to figure out how people are going to be able to work together to understand that a thriving metropolitan area is going to have to share kind of those burdens and responsibilities. So back to the tools. I mean, certainly, you know, the tools of working at the metropolitan level are linking transportation to housing development. And the reason that you obviously need to do that at a metropolitan level is that the transportation planning has to take place at a metropolitan level. And so now you can find a way to tie housing planning to it. But just to say we want to build houses close to transit doesn't really get us all the way there until we make sure that the right kind of housing is built next to transit. So we have to be able to figure out how to empower local communities and local populations who really need transit to get to jobs to have housing nearby. So we have to be able to mobilize populations, low-income populations, to insist that there's affordable housing built near transit. So we're going to have to find the right tools to mobilize, to keep engaged local populations that are going to insist and make sure that transportation planning has the right kind of housing built next to it, instead of what we'd seen in the past, transportation planning building parking garages next to transit hubs so that wealthy people could just drive there and get on the transit, right? In other places, on the downsizing of cities in responsible ways, we're going to need kind of regional authorities that are going to be able to do things like assemble land and plan for its use in different ways, green space, even, you know, assemble for other affordable housing development. And one of the tools that we've seen that's emerged that's really effective for this is a fully articulated land bank authority like they have in Flint, Michigan. And I think we're going to see dozens of those coming to the whatever county levels at least, but certainly to metropolitan areas around the country. And then, you know, other tools like land acquisition funds, even in hot market cities, are going to be able to assemble land for affordable housing development that might be used for shared equity homeownership, other forms of development, and then, you know, the tools that are going to be able to leverage subsidies that we can reach far more people by actually mixing debt and subsidies. So, for example, when we go to retrofit buildings with energy money, we shouldn't have that driven as an entirely subsidy-driven program like weatherization is now, but find ways to mix kind of the participation of the residents in the program with debt and subsidy and reach a whole lot more people. But we have to be able to get those tools and figure out how they're going to work.
Right. And that does highlight an important partner in this. The state energy offices that got quite a lot of money, and the local energy offices got, you know, in addition to the $5 billion weatherization, there's another $6 billion of money flowing to the state and local level. And that, you know, they're under pressure to get that money out as quickly as possible. But they need to think about how do you leverage that money with some of the private financing that's out there and time that repayment so that it coincides with the utility savings. I mean, there are ways to do this that will stretch that money out a lot further. I want to come back to the housing and transportation point and turn to Shelley, because as one of the nation's leading experts in this, maybe you can help us understand, well, how do you make sure, I mean, you made a really compelling case that left to its own devices, the market will do a great job of producing high-end condos near public transit, right? Because you increase demand and there's no government policy in place, it's understandable that there's going to be, there's a limited supply, price is going to rise. What can we be doing to expand the availability of affordable housing near transit? What works? And if you have any thoughts about this sort of metropolitan, regional scale question, that would be on the table as well.
Well, in some ways, I do think it really is a remaking of the rules that we've been using over the last 50, 60 years that have gotten us to the place that we're in. And there are a new set of demands that we need to begin to address, and a new set of preferences in our communities that really require a retooling top to bottom. On the other hand, I'm actually pretty optimistic. I think that when we ask people what they want for their communities, and we ask them at the right time in the decision making about various investments, we consistently get very high quality decisions. Decisions that are going to, that lead more toward the sustainable, affordable lifestyle. And you raise the California experience with the blueprint planning program that we initiated through our state climate laws that is called SB 375. But the work that is coming as a result of that to do scenario planning at the regional level with a set of measurable performance targets that have to be evaluated is indeed leading to a conversation at the very, very local level that is supportive of more compact, higher density, walkable, transit-connected local neighborhoods. So part of what I think we need to do is to reinstitute the discussion at that higher plane rather than forcing people to only have a real opportunity to talk about what they want in their communities when a permit comes forward for a particular building. Because that is not the right place to start an education process about the implications of various decisions. The other thing that I've been focusing on lately that again has to do with sort of changing the rules of the game to be able to allow what we are now seeing people really want is again about kind of looking across the boundaries of our disciplines to the decision-making processes for infrastructure investments. So my sort of favorite, ironic rule that's out there is that when a community goes to get money to build a transit project in the U.S., they have to count up the number of low-income people who live near that transit line. They do not have to make any statement about whether or not there's a possibility that these folks could continue to live in this neighborhood once the transit line is built. They get no credit for putting in place an affordable housing program. They get no credit for putting in place land acquisition funds that could be deed restricted to provide affordable housing. They get a little teeny, teeny bit of credit for doing zoning that might allow the right kind of development, but basically they don't get credit for doing the right thing. And what is happening in community after community is that stations along new transit lines are being taken out of the plans, particularly in low-income communities, because of the way the rules are gamed. Also, the other kind of thing is that, do you know you get more riders in the black box model for a transit project if you have a parking structure? then you have people that could just walk to the train. So again, we have to get savvy about the implications of all these rules that are being used to shape the infrastructure that we're investing in our communities. And it, again, requires us to get a little beyond our comfort zone and learn about, you know, the deeper understanding and meaning about why, you know, we're having bad outcomes from the housing perspective. That it's not just simply about the housing community and the rules that govern the housing markets, but it's also related to how we shape our communities and the infrastructure that we invest in.
Thank you, Shelley. It reminds me that it's, I think, worthwhile to just tell you very briefly about some of the larger initiatives that are taking place that you can participate in to help make some of these things a reality. One of them is a campaign called T for America, which stands for Transportation for America, which is focused in particular on the reauthorization of federal transportation funding. It's t4america.org. The National Housing Conference is on the executive committee. Shelley is one of the directors of that initiative. And it is an opportunity to really integrate some of these ideas about expanding the availability of affordable housing near public transit, increasing the compactness of development, to reduce carbon emissions and vehicle miles traveled. It's an opportunity to really bring some of those ideas into the discussion as part of the transportation reauthorization. And the National Housing Conference can help connect you, but you're also free to interact directly with them. And it also reminds me of an initiative that Ford is funding around shared equity homeownership, because one of the things we have learned is that once you put in major federal investments like public transit, you are having not just a temporary effect on land prices, you're likely to have a long-term effect. And what shared equity home ownership does so well, as does rental housing preservation on the rental side, which is the MacArthur Initiative, both of these initiatives really think about how do we keep housing affordable, not just today, not just in 5 years, not just in 10 years, but essentially in perpetuity. Because it doesn't do you any good just to make housing affordable near public transit for 10 years, but in 10 years or even 20 years, whoever is lucky enough to live there now gets a complete windfall where they get to benefit from all the rise in property value that's due to public investment. You haven't actually created lasting change. You need tools like shared equity home ownership that preserve affordability long term, rental housing covenants, those sorts of things. So Window of Opportunity is the name of the MacArthur Initiative. The Shared Equity Initiative is being chaired by NCB Capital Impact. I'd urge you to find out more about that. And there'll be PowerPoints on all of those things because they all presented here. As part of the follow-up postings that we put on the internet. I want to get back to Bill, and then I want to open it up to we're going to have to figure out the mic challenge of how do we actually get there. But Bill, my question for you is, you know, it seems to me, I mean, I'll confess, you know, coming from the housing world, planning seems like this other universe, right? And the okay. Best thing I've been able to figure out about planning is that we don't do a very good job of listening to our planners, right? So I understand we need to be listening. I mean, you're saying all the right things, and we have to figure out how people can listen to you, but if you could give us some tips about how we interact with the planning, folks, what do we need to do both to increase the chance that people listen to you, but also increase the chance that the ideas that we're talking about get incorporated into plans? And that would be both, I would imagine, both planning departments, but also the transportation and infrastructure planners that are working for metropolitan regional councils.
Yeah, I want to answer that question. I also want to hit what Max was talking about in land use and regional planning. We have been using a construct that we call the five strategic points of intervention, which people find useful in thinking about how you as housing advocates can best interface with your planning department and planning efforts. Now, planning varies from place to place. I'm the first to admit there are good planning departments and there are not so good planning departments. There are big ones. There are planning departments that are remote. You never go there. But here's the deal. We think there are five points of strategic intervention. And the first one is one you know very well, and that's community visioning or neighborhood visioning. If you're not there and representing the housing interest, you're going to be behind the eight ball. This is the one opportunity you have to really tap into the the inner being of the community and state where you want to be in 40 years. That's number one. Number two is plan making of all kinds. It's not just about the comprehensive plan, although the comprehensive plan certainly should have a really super housing element in it. But there are other plans. There are sub-area plans, your neighborhood plans, your downtown plan, your corridor plans, each of which should have some kind of a housing point of view to it. You have functional plans, sewer plans. Now, what could be more important to housing than sewer and water kinds of infrastructure? So planning is number two. Number three is standards, regulations, and incentives. And this is another place you have to be. When somebody says they're going to make amendments to the zoning ordinance, you need to be there. When somebody's saying they're going to tinker with the subdivision ordinance, you need to be there. You need to talk about inclusionary housing and the other kinds of land use mechanisms, both regulatory and incentives. You need to be there. The fourth one is development work, and communities do development. They do it as public-private partnerships, and they do it in other ways. When a private development comes before the planning board for approval, you need to be there to make sure that those inclusionary units are sited properly, that there is a transit stop suitably sited, and all that kind of stuff. And lastly, one you don't normally think of is something that towns and cities do routinely, and that is the capital improvements program. Towns, cities, counties spend lots of money, and this is an opportunity to really figure out, okay, where is the library going to go, okay, with respect to the community, this kind of question. So those are the five strategic points of intervention. On Mac's question about land use, it is really interesting to me that the L word is being used in Washington, and I don't mean liberal. I mean land use. People are beginning to say this is a legitimate topic for the federal government to be talking about. Not that we're going to have federal zoning or even state zoning, but land use is really important for housing. The one point that I really liked was the business about open space. And, you know, I, for one, part of my career was a planning director for a regional planning agency, and we actually went to the state legislature and got a 2% real estate transfer tax, the proceeds of which could only be used for open space acquisition. We were using open space acquisition to shape the settlement pattern, to force developers into and around existing villages and urban areas. And we had suddenly $200 million. I had zoning in one hand and $200 million in the other, and trying to use that. So, you know, this is the kind of thing that we need to begin a discussion on to help shape the settlement pattern.
Great. Thanks, Bill. We're going to take, someone's going to come up and get your mic. We're going to put it, I think, in the middle there. We have a few minutes for questions. As you're thinking about what kind of questions you might have, you're probably a little exhausted by now. It's been a long few days, but hopefully a very productive one. This has been a wonderful time. We are definitely going to get you out of here, I promise, by 11:30. As you're thinking about it, I just wanted to remark that this point about open space, there are some states, Vermont is one that's actually figured out how to link the open space issue with the housing issue. And there is a long-time alliance between the environmental sort of open space, how do we preserve our rural landscape people, and the people who say we need affordable housing, because they recognize that unless they figure about how they concentrate their development, unless they figure about how they make sure that there's housing affordable to people where they need to be, that they're going to be cutting into their land, into their land use. It'd be really interesting to kind of think about how to build those kinds of alliances at other levels. So Nick is going to take is going to make a point about that. Please line up if you have any questions at the microphone. They're sitting in a big line. Okay, Nick, quickly, and then we're going to get to the question.
Jeff, the only comment I would make, I would bring all of your attention to this program in Vermont, the Vermont Community Land Trust. I'm not sure exactly what it's called, but it is a very, very special coalition. I had a chance to study it, and again, I was incredibly impressed with the diligence, the perseverance, the coalitions. What took me aback, though, it's been around for 20 to 25 years, and it's such a good program, you kind of wonder why hasn't it been replicated in other places? And I think that's the issue I think we've all been partially alluding to. You know, I think we've learned in the crisis we are in that markets don't self-correct. I don't think public policies self-correct either, necessarily. And again, I go back to what I said before. I think there is an opportunity here to try to shape public policies, try to have the desired outcomes. And I know if you do that, you drift towards social engineering, you drift toward other L words that we're kind of worried about. But I think there is this sort of opportunity now to mold public policy so that the Vermont experience is not just a Vermont experience, that it provides a fertile environment for that to take place in other places.
Right. It's a really good point, and this is partly why we're trying to facilitate at the Center for Housing Policy, trying to facilitate this cross-site learning and exchange, because there's a lot of good things happening, but we haven't had the forum to do that, which reminds me everyone should join the housingpolicy.org forum so that you can participate and learn directly from each other about how to do this. And if we had everybody in this room and five of your closest friends join the forum, imagine the brain power that we'd be harvesting and tapping